It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf and Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced a 10-year deal between UPMC and Highmark yesterday, eliminating a years-long standoff that would have left thousands of patients in the Pittsburgh area without in-network care across providers. Josh Shapiro helped negotiate the deal and joins us on the line from Harrisburg. Good morning. Welcome back to the Confluence.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Earlier this month, when Commonwealth Court ruled against your position regarding extending a soon-to-end consent decree between UPMC and Highmark, did you believe that less than 2 weeks later you would be announcing a 10-year deal?
Well, look, I always stayed focused on the goal, which was to make sure that people had health care security, that they had real choice, and that there was stability in the marketplace. And as I said many times on this program and others, I was very clear with Highmark and UPMC with what I expected. Highmark accepted the terms of what I laid out early on in this process. UPMC didn't. It set off a 137-day legal battle. But I always made clear that I was willing to talk, and I always made clear that I was willing to listen. And when UPMC reached out, actually prior to that judicial ruling that you talked about, which obviously would not have been the final word on all of this, I thought it was important that we begin to have a dialogue. And over the last, you know, I guess it was 8 days, we went back and forth. It was intense. It was honest. It was direct. And ultimately, it worked to the betterment of Western Pennsylvania and the good folks there. And so I wanted to make sure that I could get this done for them. And I had two willing partners in Jeffrey Romoff and David Holmberg to get it done. And not just get it done in the short term, but get it done for a decade.
You said you went back and forth. I was wondering, did you get Jeffrey Romoff from UPMC and David Holmberg of Highmark in the same room, or did you have to do sort of your own version of shuttle diplomacy?
Yeah. Look, I said I'm not going to get into the specifics, but what I said yesterday, I'll repeat. It began as a dialogue directly between me and Jeffrey Romoff, then between me and David Holmberg, culminating with conversations between the three of us. We met face-to-face. We talked by phone. We texted. It was very intense. But most importantly, for your listeners, it was productive because they now have healthcare security. They have choice. And these two great institutions have an ability to plan for the future and make critical investments and be in a position where they can do a lot of good for this community for years to come.
Did you get a sense that UPMC was feeling maybe the effect of what was some negative publicity?
I think that's really a question you have to direct to them. We never spoke about that. We never focused on that. We always just focused on the task at hand, which was making sure that we had healthcare security and options for people going forward.
Mm-hmm. UPMC declined to join us, at least Mr. Romoff did, on the program today. Do you sense that they were concerned to a challenge to their nonprofit status might be successful?
Look, I don't know what they were feeling. I know what we discussed, and what we discussed at every juncture was how can we put a contract in place that provides stability and security? How can we do away with this back and forth that had gone on for the last 5 years, really, if not more, and instead usher in a new era? And one of the things I talked about yesterday in announcing this deal, and I think this is an important point, I don't want us to miss this, is that these two massive, you know, and successful healthcare institutions are going to go from adversaries to allies. That's a pledge that was made not just to me, but to one another. And I think that's really important for all of us. And it means really great opportunities for everyone in the future.
If they're allies, why weren't the leaders of UPMC and Highmark standing with you and Governor Wolf at the lectern?
I think, you know, we all made the judgment that it was important that I make this announcement, and I think we were all very comfortable with how that played out.
Okay. Part of the deal includes you dropping a lawsuit your office filed against UPMC, I believe it was in February. Are you good with that?
Well, that's not accurate, actually,
okay.
And I mean that respectfully. Let me explain. The lawsuit that we filed was predicated on or built on the consent decrees, right? So I filed it based on those consent decrees. Well, those consent decrees are set to now expire on June 30th. So the lawsuit will have to be withdrawn. And really, the crux of the lawsuit dealt with two things, if you think about it. One was making sure there was health care security. We've now accomplished that through this contract. And the other was the charitable issues. And as I said yesterday, and I'll repeat here, I will continue to uphold all the laws in this Commonwealth and hold everybody accountable to them, including our charities laws, whether it's UPMC or some other institution. So none of that changes and none of that goes away. So to suggest that we dropped the lawsuit in exchange for this, it's just simply not accurate. It was predicated upon the consent decrees, and those are set to expire June 30th. Of course, the contract will take its place. And I think that's also something important for folks to understand. The consent decrees effectively were a contract between Highmark, UPMC, and the state government, right? Right. This is now a contract between those two institutions. That's good news that we can get government out of the center of it. We're still going to be overseers. We're still going to regulate. We're still going to hold people accountable to our laws. But the fact that we don't have to be a signatory to the contract, I think, shows you that willingness to cooperate and work together and that trust that these two institutions are rebuilding together. And that works to all of our benefit.
In our minute that we have left with you, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, you said government not involved. It's a contract between the two. However, several legislators from Western Pennsylvania have praised the agreement, but also said still legislation is needed to prevent this from happening again. Do you agree that that is necessary?
Well, look, I think that's up to them. I've said many times, I'm a law enforcer, not a lawmaker. They'll go about doing what they think is best. I think, you know, the real winners here and are obviously the people. And I think we can't lose sight of the fact that, you know, their voices were heard in this process. I mean, I know that when I was sitting at the table or on the phone and engaging in dialogue with David and Jeffrey, those were the people I was thinking about all the time. Those are the people I was fighting for. I was in the room for them. And ultimately, their voices, their willingness to come on your radio program and write letters to the editor and hold rallies and speak up in their communities and speak up on their, you know, Facebook pages and Twitter timelines and what have you, that moved the needle. That made a difference. This was a combination of people power and, you know, tough talks and ultimately corporate responsibility. And I think that's a great lesson here. And I think it's a great template for getting things done, not just in Western Pennsylvania, but across the board. You know, when people rise up, when people's voices are heard, good things can happen. And I got to tell you, I'm listening and I hear them.
Josh Shapiro is Pennsylvania's Attorney General. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Always good to be with you. Thank you.
And with us in studio is health and science reporter Sarah Bowden, who has been covering the UPMC Highmark dispute for WESA. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So the big winners in this deal are the patients, right?
Oh, definitely. Specifically people with Highmark insurance who want to continue going to UPMC's facilities, or people with Highmark insurance who just want to go to UPMC's facilities in general, because it expands the number, the pool of Highmark people with Highmark insurance who can go to UPMC.
And they will still be paying the in-network rates, is that correct?
Yeah, not only will the people who currently seen UPMC providers will be continue paying the in-network rate, but now people with Highmark who have not been going to UPMC can now go to UPMC and pay in-network rates.
You were at the press conference yesterday, mm-hmm. Josh Shapiro had with Governor Wolf. What did you hear this morning, just minutes ago, from Josh Shapiro that stood out to you?
Well, I thought it was interesting that Josh Shapiro didn't really want to get into what was motivating UPMC or Highmark, especially UPMC, besides the fact that, you know, Shapiro was talking about the importance of this for patients. But then the Attorney General did say a little later in your conversation that he wanted to thank everyone who had spoken out and talked about how the separation between UPMC and Highmark was going to adversely affect them. And so while the Attorney General did not specifically say public opinion, public pressure had been pressuring UPMC, he did mention public pressure, and then he would not directly comment on whether or not public pressure was a factor in UPMC's decision making. And in fairness, we didn't ask UPMC whether or not that was a factor. But I thought that was kind of an interesting reading between the lines.
When talking to Mr. Shapiro, I asked him about the lawsuit against UPMC. I have a question. Highmark had also filed five years back, a lawsuit against UPMC regarding billing for oncology services. Does that go away with this deal, from your understanding?
Yeah. Highmark, I spoke with David Holmberg yesterday, and he said that they were withdrawing or dropping, whatever nomenclature you want to use, that lawsuit.
All right. Of course, Holmberg is the CEO of Highmark. What else did he tell you? You spoke to him. He was not at the press conference, but you spoke to him by phone afterwards. What else stood out from your conversation?
Well, I was really interested to know if there would that this agreement also allowed UPMC, people of UPMC insurance, to go to Allegheny Health Network facilities, which is owned by Highmark. That's right. A health system owned by Highmark.
So a quid pro quo.
And this agreement does not cover that. So, which, you know, the main concern has always been people with Highmark insurance going to UPMC facilities. And I haven't really heard of anyone being concerned with UPMC insurance not being able to go to AHN, but I thought that was interesting.
Well, of course, UPMC, a much bigger healthcare provider than AHN.
Certainly.
Now, Mr. Romoff declined requests by the Confluence for an interview, but you talked with the UPMC spokesman, Paul Wood. Did he tell you why UPMC agreed to the deal, or what did he tell you?
He didn't really get into specifics. He said that there was, I guess you could say that he felt like there was a willingness to negotiate, and that the negotiations with Hillman, which allowed AHN or Highmark customers to go to Hillman in network rates, he felt like that had gone fairly well. And so that kind of opened the door.
The Hillman Cancer Facility.
But I was very shocked because when I spoke with Paul Wood 1 or 2 weeks ago, it really had seemed like this was not on the table at all.
And, of course, the new agreement between UPMC and Highmark starts July 1, the day after the five-year consent decree ends. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up later, a conversation with counterterrorism researcher Michael Kenney about how the FBI has gotten better in stopping attacks through undercover stings. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
One Size Fits All is the 10th and final studio album from Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. Released on this day in 1975, the record features George Duke, Chester Thompson, Ruth Underwood, Tom Fowler, and Napoleon Murphy Brock. The record also features Johnny Guitar Watson, a hero of Zappa's, and Captain Beefheart, Zappa's longtime friend. At the time, Zappa stated that One Size Fits All and the band's follow-up album were recorded at the same time, but the latter was never released, and the Mothers were no longer Zappa's band. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh-based author Adam Ehrlich Sacks is getting national attention for his debut novel, The Organs of Sense. It's a playful, fable-like book whose main character is real-life 17th-century German philosopher Gottfried Leibniz. Sacks spoke with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll.
The novel is set in 1666. It involves things like a blind astronomer, an attempt to make a mechanical human head, increasingly lengthy astral tubes or telescopes, as we would think of them, and a half-insane royal family. Right. So why these characters? Why this time period?
Well, I was going for topicality. You know, it's, there's something intriguing, I think, about the 17th century, in that it was the century of the scientific revolution, of course, but it was also a time when people we think of as scientists, you know, Hooke and Leibniz himself, were also interested in marvels and unicorns and monsters. And by the 18th century, everything was kind of cleanly demarcated. And in the 17th century, it was all up for grabs.
This might be a good time to hear a little bit from the novel. Do you want to set up this part?
So the astronomer has a cat that is sitting on his lap for much of the novel. And here he discusses it. An aphorism, declared the astronomer. A man delighted by a cat is discomfited by existence. A man delighted by existence is discomfited by a cat. A cat owner is invariably an individual not in possession of any consoling doctrines or articles of faith, just as an individual in possession of some such doctrine invariably has no cats. A man who believes he possesses both a cat and a consoling doctrine will discover at some dreadful moment when his faith is put to the test that his doctrine is not truly consoling, or if it is, that his cat is not really a cat. In his blackest hour, he discovers that the doctrine on which he has founded his life is without any foundation, or if it does have a foundation, his cat is a dog, the astronomer said, according to Leibniz.
There's a lot of conversations in the book, or a lot of comical interrogation of what are the limits of things like reason, limits of language, right? The nature of sensory perception. Talk about some of those themes, like why do they interest you so much?
Leibniz was kind of a great rationalist and sort of the great reactionary philosophically of the 17th century. He was reacting to people like Spinoza and Descartes, the sort of threatening, modernizing philosophers who were casting doubt on what we could know. You know, Descartes says we can only really know our own mind with certainty. And Spinoza threatened free will and the soul and other comforting notions like that. So Leibniz's whole philosophy, in a sense, is to try to defend those things, those common sense ideas.
I saw you talk in another interview about how you're drawn to narratives that involve not sort of naturalistic or realistic presentations of how people interact, but quote, some obscure logic working itself out. And you talked about how one of your influences is sketch comedy.
I'm not into realist fiction, but I'm also not into the kind of surrealism where anything goes and there's no governing logic and just anything can take place. I kind of like some merging of the two, where you start from some recognizable premise or you have a single premise you accept. And this is true both in Kafka and in sketch comedy, I would say. You know, you wake up one morning as a beetle or you're arrested for no reason one morning. Having accepted that basic premise, you just kind of then logically, rigorously work it out.
There's also this kind of interesting nesting thing that happens with the narrative, because you frame it as Leibniz giving this report years later about his visit to this astronomer who's telling a story that happened decades and decades earlier, right?
Yeah.
What's the appeal of that approach to you?
As I say, I have this kind of student-y impulse to get things right and accurate. So it helps me to give the story over to a crazy person, and that frees me up. And then if that crazy person encounters an even crazier person, then I feel even freer. So just on the level of sitting down day to day, that sort of nesting feel helped me get to the place of lunacy that I was aiming for.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll speaking with Adam Ehrlich-Sachs about his debut novel, The Organs of Sense. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The EPA and U.S. Department of Agriculture are partnering to help communities improve access to fresh food and support downtown reinvestment through their Local Foods, Local Places initiative. Aliquippa is one of just 15 communities to be selected for this program and the only one chosen from Pennsylvania. Donald Walker is the chairman of the Aliquippa Economic Development Corporation. He joins us to talk about the program. Donald, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the invite.
Tell us a little bit more about the Local Foods, Local Places program and why you think Aliquippa is a good fit for it.
When I initially read the grant, I had to wait, read through it and process it a little bit because it's an in-depth project as far mm-hmm. as what you need to do, but it's a complete community involvement. What that is like it makes you bring community entities together to create a bridge gap to help. Health and wellness, because mm-hmm. pretty much that grant deals with health and wellness, and it also carries into incubators where you can bring, having, let's say, like a farmer's market, so to speak, and then you can actually get a restaurant to come through your downtown to generate jobs and generate it like a grocery store, because Aliquippa does not have one. Mm-hmm. You know, back when I was a child, we did have one. At one time it was IGA, then it was it's shifted to something else and then eventually closing.
So is Aliquippa at this point considered, what we hear that term, food desert?
Yes, sir. You can say that. Yes, sir. I mean, we do have grocery stores. We have an Aldi's, which is about less than a mile and a half, 2 miles away from our downtown area. Mm-hmm. We also have a Giant Eagle. We have a Coons in the Hopewell area. But as far as the downtown area, which you consider a downtown, we do not have a grocery store. We do have a Dollar General coming shortly. Hopefully that'll be opened up here pretty soon. Hopefully by the 4th of July, if not by later, a little bit after that.
So something in that extensive application process caught your eye.
Yes, sir, it did.
And say, this will fit.
It will fit, and it is actually needed. It's a game changer in a sense, or a game added, I would say.
I understand that the Local Foods, the Local Places Initiative, provides expertise rather than direct funding.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you plan to leverage that expertise into that development, into greater access?
You know what? Partnerships. I think that's the key word right there is partnerships. Bringing those people into our town, and letting them see for themselves what we actually need as opposed to describing it to them. You know, when you go to our downtown, you'll see dilapidated buildings, you'll see the things that Governor Wolf talks about, you'll see all that in my town. But what I want to do is change the narrative, you know, and I think, you know, Mayor, who happens to be my twin brother, he's trying to change the narrative when he says, you know, you got to see it like childlike eyes. You got to see the development as opposed to the dilapidation in it. So with that being said, you know, I think when you get him there and you see the needs and the pressing needs, you hope one of them will tug on a heartstring. And, you know, say, hey, yeah, like, you know what, let's give Alcoba a chance. Let's put a grocery store down here. Or even, you know, spark someone's imagination and say, hey, you know what, I want to be a store owner. And I want to put an organic store down here. And I want to put a grocery store down in downtown Aliquippa. Because we had it before, so it's not like we can't get it back, you know?
This federal program has a dual approach to develop local food sources,
yes,
while also revitalizing the community. How do you see those two goals intersecting in Aliquippa?
Oh, like twins. You know, it's like twins. They go hand in hand together. You know, revitalization is a key component. It's like a phoenix, you know, and we use that word a lot, you know, as far as like just trying to rechange the narrative because we've tried everything else. So this local foods, local partnership is a great thing. It's something different. It's out of the box thinking. And I think it'll generate a lot of good things with community involvement.
So how are you seeking input from residents, from organizations, from individuals, and how do you plan to incorporate their suggestions into your plans?
What you do is you meet with them. See, I'm also a city councilman. So when you come to meetings, they look for like things for kids to do. They're looking for different avenues to put a park downtown. For example, Uncommon Grounds is a strong partner in it. We you know these are already partners that we already have existing in the city of Aliquippa, and they're already feeding our Salvation Army feeds community. They feed 575 people. They, you know, give meals, you know, boxes of meals and things like that. So what you do is you don't reinvent the wheel. You talk to those groups and you piggyback off of that and you pull them in as partners. So when we go at this, like the local foods partnership and different things like that, you already have those groups in place. So all you have to do is just move forward, you know, as a collective group, you know?
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Donald Walker. He's the chairman of the Aliquippa Economic Development Corporation. And Aliquippa is one of just 15 communities nationwide to be selected for the Local Foods, Local Places federal initiative. Access to fresh food, it's only part of the equation.
Yes,
education is also a big factor,
yes,
in creating healthier communities that you,
yes,
were talking,
sir,
about,
yes,
earlier.
Sir.
So how do you plan to meld the learning into this program about, hey, now we have access, but you got to take advantage of it.
Right. Well, first, get the word out. Because a lot of communities like Aliquippa, it seems like, you know, if you don't get the word out, they don't know. And all of a sudden, they see tents pop up in their downtown. They don't know what it is. So getting the word out is a key component to that. And that's educating as well. Utilize your B.F. Jones libraries that we have. It's a gold mine for us. And it's a gem for the city of Aliquippa. You know, you do have people walking in and out of there daily. Between that and social media outreach and then having those, you know, meetings where you say, hey, you're invited to this. And, you know, enticing them with food and drinking. To get them to come in and say, hey, this is coming in late August, early September. We need you to do that. Or participate in a number counter, participate in listening what's going on. What does the toolbox look like for local foods, local partnerships?
That awareness education can sometimes bubble from the ground up, maybe through our schools, through our,
yes,
kids,
sir,
through our students,
yes,
to,
sir,
sort of connect with their parents.
Yes, sir.
So how do you plan to connect with the schools to do
what
this?
What you just said, you know, if you entice a kid, like say, hey, we'll have a, you know, it's got to be something that I pull the kids down, so the kids said, dad, I want to go, or mom, I want to go to that. But you pull them in. The library be a key component to that because you can go in there and read. You can have computers, you have books, and you have people doing educational groups where they do readings and they do things. And then while their kids are sitting there getting all that, you pull them aside and say, hey, look at this. This is what we're trying to do in the downtown area. We're trying to bring local food, local partnership. We're trying to bring a farmer's market here, organic foods. You know, and if you have interest in opening a store, maybe, you know, a grocery store that's locally driven, you know, locally pushed, you know, fed through the farms in and around our area. So
mm-hmm. Whether it's organic, fresh foods,
yes,
they,
sir,
have to be supported.
Yes.
I mean, to, you know, to survive. And as part of that, convincing people, you know what, it's here and I'll take advantage?
Yes, sir. And give us a chance. Like, you know, you've never seen a farmer's market in downtown Aquipa. In towns like ours, you don't. You wouldn't. But at the same time, it's out-of-the-box sneakers and pulling them in to say, hey, look, give us a chance. Let these people see that, and you'll be surprised. It's a lot of folks that live in throughout the downtown area. We have assisted living down there. We have, you know, elderly homes, income housing. So it's there. And some of them don't have cars, so they'll walk down, and you'll get that presence there.
Mm-hmm. As you're well aware of, the city of Aliquippa entered Act 47 financially distressed status, I think, 31 years ago.
I'm 44, so I've lived through it.
I believe the city has submitted its exit plan.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
How will initiatives such as local foods, local places, and other plans help stabilize the community?
In so many ways. Again, opportunities. It's the changing of it. The city, they say, hey, Aliquippa is open to a lot of things. We ain't the old mom and pop steel mill anymore. So we got to go out of the box thinking, and that creates that, you know. And I think a lot of people think, you know, it'll never come back, I don't believe that. You know, and I think creating partnerships through AEDC, creating partnership through the city of Aliquippa, the school district, the water authority, those create those gaps and bridges that say we're working together to change the outlook of Aliquippa. And, you know, all we're asking is partners to get on board and come along, you know?
And it sounds like you're saying, just give us a chance.
Give us a chance, period.
Okay.
Give us a chance.
So how do you plan? So you're talking about a lot of changes.
Yes, sir.
To revitalize Aliquippa, but how do you sustain the changes after this period with this particular program and others that you want to continue?
You know, involvement and evolving, you know, constantly changing, because you can't be stuck in the same pattern. So eventually you had to say, all right, what worked and what didn't work? And I think the local food, local partnership, and what I've read and the things I've studied on it, you know, they haven't done everything perfectly. Other communities haven't done it perfectly. And they also show you what they did wrong. So what you have to do is you say what they did wrong. Don't concentrate what they did right, because that's there. But concentrate what they did wrong and make sure you don't do that same thing. You know, whether it's lack of communication, whether it's lack of information given out. You know, inclusion is a key component of that, too. I think communities like ours, certain groups tend to think like they get left out, but that's not the case. You have to include everyone in that process to move it forward. So, and I'm praying to God that that's what happens. Everybody see it, you know, the partnership in it. And realize it is not about an individual RC in particular, it's about the groups that move the city forward. So
sounds like you're an optimist about Aliquippa's future.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know why? Because I'll tell you a story. The reason why I'm in the position I'm in is not because of money, it's not because of status. My sister was murdered September 5th, 2009. She was killed in the city of Aliquippa by a boyfriend. So to be optimistic, I've seen the worst. Me and my twin brother, and my family have gone through the worst, you know. So why not be optimistic? Why not look at opportunities like a child's eyes and realize it could be something different? You know, I can live in a wallow. I can be sad about it, and I've been through that phase. But I understand what's out here is bigger. I wouldn't be put in this place if God didn't want me here, you know. And that's how I feel about it.
Donald Walker is the chairman for the Aliquippa Economic Development Corporation. Aliquippa, one of just 15 communities nationwide to be selected for the Local Foods, Local Places initiative. Donald, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite. I really do.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The fear of terrorism returned to many of our minds, at least briefly, after a man was arrested by the FBI last week for allegedly plotting to bomb a church in Pittsburgh's North Side in the name of the Islamic State. Michael Kenny teaches counterterrorism at the University of Pittsburgh. He's the program director of international affairs at its Graduate School of Public and International Affairs, and he's also the author of The Islamic State in Britain, Radicalization and Resilience in an Activist Network. Michael, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, you've done a lot of research on terrorist attack groups, how they develop. Does the incident that was uncovered last week, does that sound typical to you?
It sounds fairly typical for what we've seen here in the U.S. in recent years, specifically plots related to ISIS. It's quite typical in that sense. What I mean by that is that like a number of other incidents, the plot was disrupted by the FBI and other law enforcers through what they sometimes call an undercover sting operation.
Mm-hmm. Have they gotten better at this through the years? Have you noticed in your research?
I believe the FBI in particular has gotten quite adept at running undercover operations, specifically targeting ISIS-related individuals and groups.
How do these plans, give us an idea how plans for attacks usually play out. How common are they?
You mean with respect to ISIS-related plans?
Yes, exactly.
Actually, they're not as common here in the U.S. as you might expect, given the media attention to the issue. Since around March of 2014, only 182 individuals in the U.S. have been charged with ISIS-related terrorism crimes. Now, you might think on the face of it, 182 sounds like a lot. In Europe, they're dealing with thousands of individuals. So when compared to Western Europe, the degree of the ISIS-related threat that we have faced in the U.S. has thankfully been much more manageable.
How do they define ISIS-related? Do they have to say this is in the name of ISIS? Is there something? Or can they find that maybe they were influenced by ISIS?
Typically, what you'd look for is some sort of statement or some sort of indication, whether that's online or offline, that the perpetrator accepts the ISIS ideology, which is very similar to the Al-Qaeda ideology, that they accept it and that they support it. Of course, many people have radical ideas and don't necessarily translate those ideas into action. So if you're talking about an actual terrorist plot, law enforcers are always looking for more evidence of that. And that's what undercover operations are designed to uncover, is evidence that they can use for criminal prosecution.
So how do they find them? Is it strictly monitoring the internet? Is it keeping an eye on dark websites?
All that and more, really. The FBI and other law enforcers have become very proficient at using online resources at their disposal. In this case, the young man was quite open about sharing his pro-ISIS views on social media as well as encrypted applications. That's how the FBI first learned about this guy. They also learned about another perpetrator in Wisconsin who pled guilty to a similar offense. And from that initial tip, the FBI was able to monitor this young man here in Pittsburgh quite closely, and the plot developed out of that. For example, this plot that was uncovered last week involved three perpetrators.
Right.
Two of them worked for the FBI. One was an undercover FBI agent, and the other was what they call a human confidential source. Only one person was the actual perpetrator.
So the sharing of information on social media, that can work two ways. You might get, quote, legitimate support for ISIS-related activities. You might find a brother, if you would, in that, or the FBI, counter-terrorists, could spot that.
Exactly. That's exactly the point. The social media encrypted apps are not only tools for terrorists, they're tools for law enforcers who are trying to protect us. They are a force multiplier for the good guys as well as the bad guys.
You've done a lot of research about Islamic State linked groups in England. Are there similar groups in the U.S.? Do they tend to differ from the U.K. ones?
Back in the day, there were a small number of groups that were very similar to what I was looking at in the U.K. In recent years, they've been largely disrupted. Their perpetrators have been sentenced for various crimes. Others have stopped their activism. So again, the scale of what we face in the U.S. is not on the same order of what I talk about in my book in the U.K.
Mm-hmm. Strategies for prevention of law enforcement here in the U.S. versus law enforcement, whether it's in the U.K. or in Europe, do they compare? Do they contrast?
I think this case reminds us that the FBI and other law enforcers have become proficient at intervention, you know, at disrupting plots and keep them from actually carrying out violence. That's wonderful. That's good news. They help to make all of us safer. Where I feel like we could do better in the U.S. is on the prevention and what is sometimes called countering violent extremism. The prevention side, It's become very controversial in recent years, and part as a result of that, we don't have the programs in place that could have helped in a situation like this.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking about terrorism and counterterrorism with author and expert Michael Kenny of the University of Pittsburgh. Does the U.S. have more of a lone wolf aspect to its potential terrorists?
Yeah, I don't love the term lone wolf, okay. But you're absolutely right to use it. It is, you know, the standard term to refer to a single individual. It's sometimes used to refer to small groups. It gets a little muddy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is a main element of the threat. But that's also a sign of good news because law enforcers, the government, the counterterrorism environment has become so hostile, it's much harder for larger organized groups to coordinate because that always creates an operational signature that can be detected and disrupted. So lone wolves are harder to disrupt that way. Here in this case, this appears to have been a single individual working alone. Again, the two other perpetrators were actually working for the government.
Mm-hmm. What can you glean from the intended method of a modern, if you would, terrorism plot? Let's face it, it doesn't take much to have a mass shooting terror event, just the guns and maybe the body armor, but a bombing, that seems to be a little more sophisticated.
A bombing is more sophisticated. A bombing requires more knowledge, requires more materiel. It's harder to do. The ISIS sympathizers still like these sorts of attacks because that's what they read about in their literature. However, they also read about other attack methods that are much simpler, and there's other weapons here in the U.S. that are frankly a lot easier to acquire than it is to build bombs. So those are the sorts of attack methods that personally worry me more. It's just a little harder to build bombs. And again, if you're going to build a bomb, you have to go out, you have to buy acetone, you have to buy batteries, you have to buy shrapnel. And when people do that, that presents opportunities for law enforcers to try to intervene.
And those other methods, are they just as deadly maybe as a bomb?
A bomb, what's good about a bomb is it allows you, when it's done correctly, you can kill more people relatively quickly. However, knives, cars, guns, right. You can obviously kill a lot of people with the right sort of gun.
Okay, we have less than 2 minutes remaining. I want to ask you, the young man arrested, a Syrian refugee, how do incidents such as this affect the refugee community in the city, would you say?
Well, I mean, obviously people get upset. They worry. One thing that is an understandable fear would be a potential rise in anti-Muslim attacks after an incident such as this. So this is what local communities here in Pittsburgh should be concerned about. Are we going to see a reaction to this plot? I'm sure they already understand this. I'm sure they're already working with their local law enforcement partners to safeguard their places of worship. So that would be one thing. And then the people directly impacted, the family, my guess is they're frankly devastated. You know, they came over here seeking a better way of life. This was one young man, part of a larger family. I think most of the people in that family were just seeking a better life. My guess is those folks are frankly devastated right now.
In a sentence, what do you think the city should do next to maybe protect itself from potential actions?
Well, what the city is already doing. Mayor Peduto came out with a strong statement of support. That helps local law enforcers, the local special agent in charge of the Pittsburgh division, Bob Jones, issued a similar statement. The places of worship have to continue to take precautionary measures, all places of worship, no matter what your faith denomination, to protect your spots of worship.
Michael Kenny is the Program Director of International Affairs at the University of Pittsburgh. He teaches counterterrorism. He's the author of The Islamic State in Britain, Radicalization and Resilience in an Activist Network. Michael, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the Pennsylvania legislature has approved a constitutional amendment to enshrine the rights of crime victims. Plus, we'll hear about Breathe, a new art exhibit centered on telling stories of freedom, happiness, power, and individuality through African-American artists. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.